Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum and your chair for today. It is a pleasure to extend a special welcome to new club members who are here. We know you'll enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please turn off your cell phones and other devices. Now, here are some of our coming Science and Technology member-led forum events. On Monday, March 10th, we have a panel on the state of personal robotics. On Monday, March 24th, Arthur M. Shapiro will discuss ecological communities and the march of time. These are just two of many upcoming programs, and we invite you to check our website for complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at www.commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now that all cell phones and portable devices are turned off. And now we'll begin today's program. Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Svante Paabo. Dr. Svante Paabo is a Swedish biologist specializing in evolutionary genetics. He is the director of the Department of Genetics at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany. Dr. Paabo is known as one of the founders of paleogenetics, a discipline that uses the methods of genetics to study early humans and other ancient populations. Dr. Paabo has received many awards and accolades. Among his many achievements are the first demonstration of DNA survival in an ancient Egyptian mummy, the first amplification of ancient DNA, the first study of the DNA from the ice mouth found in the Alps, and the first retrieval of DNA from a Neanderthal in 1997. In 2006, Dr. Paabo announced a plan to reconstruct the entire genome of Neanderthals. In 2007, he was named one of the Time magazine's 100 most influential people of the year. In May 2010, Dr. Paabo and his colleagues published a draft sequence of the Neanderthal genome in the journal Science. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Svante Paabo.
Thank you very much. So, what I then wanted to do here is to discuss with you what we can learn about the origin of modern humans, that is, the type of humans that exist all over the planet today, by studying the genome of our very closest extinct relative, the Neanderthals, and the sort of technical developments and work that have gone into making it possible that we can today study in detail genomes of extinct species and extinct groups of organisms such as Neanderthals goes back now in the meantime over 30 years. And how this all came about is sort of what I've tried to describe in this book, including not only the science, but also the sort of mistakes I made on the way and the conflicts and things like that. But instead of now recounting what's exactly in the book, What I wanted to do here is sort of discuss some of the insights that have emerged from this work over the years. And in the end, the last 10 minutes or so, discuss where we might want to go with this in the future. But so before now starting, I wanted to remind you about what you all know, that our genetic material, our DNA, is stored on the chromosomes, which exist in almost all cells in our body. And it's stored in the form of this very famous double helical DNA molecule. And the information there is present twice, so to say. So the information is stored in the sequence of these four bases, abbreviated A, T, C, and G. And it's each strand carries information in a complementary form. So whenever there's an A on one strand in this molecule, there's a T on the other. Whenever there's a G on one, there's a C on the other. And this is very important because when a cell divides, and particularly of interest to us is, of course, the germline where new individuals may emerge, there are enzymes that unwind these strands from each other and synthesize new strands with the old as a template, so you get two new copies of the genome for the new daughter cells. And this process is very accurate, but nothing is, of course, absolutely accurate in nature. So sometimes an error is made, say an A is built into against a C, where it should really be a G. And if that is not repaired rapidly enough before the cell divides again, it results in a mutation in the genome. So every baby that is born carries in the order of 100, 200 new mutations that are there neither in the father nor in the mother. And we can observe the results of these mutations when we compare sequences, DNA sequences from the genome in the population today. So if we compare two people in this room, somewhere every 1,200, 1,300 bases or so, will there be a difference between us? If we add a chimpanzee in, we will find a difference every 100 bases or so, because more time has elapsed since we shared a common ancestor with the chimp. And when we want to reconstruct the history of a piece of DNA, what we do is take our best models for how these mutations occur and reconstruct the history. And we generally depict that history in a form of a tree, where we trace back in time, in this case very simply, the two human DNA sequences come to a common ancestor quite recently in time, and quite much further back is there a common ancestor shared with the chimpanzees also. And as you also know, our genome is a bit over 3 billion bases long. So when we compare two complete genomes, say between two people in this room, or between the two genomes each of you carry from your mother and from your father, we have in the order of 3 million differences or so between these genomes. So there is quite a lot of information there to reconstruct the history from. And if you do this on a global scale, what you will find is that most variation among people is to be found in Africa. And if we take the entire world outside Africa, although there are perhaps almost 10 times more people, of course, living outside Africa than inside Africa, there is less variation there. And not only that, most of the DNA sequences outside Africa have close relatives inside Africa. But there is a component of the gene pool of the variation in Africa that doesn't exist outside. So the interpretation of this is that modern humans evolved in Africa, accumulated variation there, and a part of that variation, so to say, went out and colonized the rest of the world. And by genetic tricks, you can even estimate when that exodus out of Africa started, and it's in the order of 100,000 years ago, or actually less. So this is already sort of the basis for the recent African origins model for modern humans. But there is, if you like, a problem with this, and that is that there were many other forms of humans around much, much before 100,000 years ago, of course. For example, most famously then in Europe, the Neanderthals, and in Asia, other forms of now extinct humans that are less well understood how we should classify them. So what would be very nice would be to be able to study their relationship to present-day humans. But then, of course, you have to go back and try to study the DNA in such old remains. And that is technically challenging, and is sort of described then in the book here. How started that back in the 80s with Egyptian mummies? Egyptian mummies are not that old, 2 to 4, 5 thousand years old. But they look very well preserved when we look at them. So it seemed at the time quite reasonable to say maybe there is DNA preserved in there. So I started working on that by first looking in a microscope on such tissues from such mummies. And that was generally a very frustrating thing to do. So if you look at, say, a present-day human muscle, you nicely see the muscle fibers, you see the cell nuclei in the cells where the genomes are stored. But if you go and look in an ancient Egyptian mummy, you barely see there are muscle fibers, you see no structure inside the cells, there is no DNA preserved. But fortunately, at the time, my previous professor of Egyptology had good relations to what was then East Germany. So I was able to travel to East Berlin and collect samples from a very large number of mummies. And among them were then some exceptions that were better preserved. The first one was a mummy of a little girl that's 2,400 years old. And in the skin of this girl, you could see in the basal levels things that looked like cell nuclei. And you could also stain them for DNA to see that's DNA in them. So I, of course, got very enthusiastic and extracted that DNA and transferred it into bacteria, cloned it in bacteria, which was the technology at the time to do this, and showed that among those bacteria were some that carried pieces of human DNA. And I published that, and now in hindsight, because I'm quite convinced that this microscopy is correct, that there was DNA preserved in the cell nuclei, but in hindsight, it's very clear that the DNA sequences I saw were contamination from myself or from the museum keeper in Berlin or something like that. Because what has become clear then over the years is that there's very little DNA, first of all, preserved in such remains. So, say, in the order of 10,000 to a millionfold less than you would extract from the same amount of fresh tissue. And the vast majority of the DNA is not from, say, the mummy itself, but from bacteria that have grown in the tissues after the death of the individual. So that means that if small amounts of present-day DNA enters your experiment, say from a dust particles in a room like this, where many people are, is to a big extent skin fragments from people that do contain DNA. If such a little dust particle lands in the present-day experiment, it's not a problem because it will be vastly outnumbered by the DNA molecules you want to study. But if the same amounts come in here, it might overwhelm the whole experiment and you end up studying DNA from yourself or your neighbors or something like that. So it's described in the book how over the years we get more and more paranoid over this. We, for example, can show that in all mammoth remains we study, we can detect human DNA that obviously is not from the organism in question, to a point where we now work in sort of spacesuit-like dresses in special labs where we have filtered air and high pressure so that dust cannot enter the room, much like a chip factory, for example, to avoid contamination. Much of the work also focused not on the nuclear genome that comes from mothers and fathers, but from this mitochondrial genome, a tiny part of the genome that we have only from our mothers, but which has the advantage that it occurs in hundreds, if not thousands, of copies per cell. So it's a much bigger chance that a few molecules of it will survive and we can retrieve it. So we worked our way back over time. This work started at Berkeley, actually, when I was a postdoc here. We started by studying zoological specimens collected by biologists from the university over the last 70, 80, 90 years. For example, kangaroo rats from the Mojave Desert, and went out with the field maps from that time and collected new kangaroo rats at precisely the places they had been collected then 70, 80 years earlier to study population changes over time. started also going back further in time to extinct animals, more recently extinct animals, such as the marsupial wolf from Australia that became extinct just 100 years ago from overhunting, and to animals that became extinct during the last glaciation, like the ground sloths in America or mammoths and mastodons, for example. But our real interest was really in Neanderthals then. And Neanderthals, they appear in the fossil record, depending now a bit on how you define a Neanderthal, but somewhere between perhaps 300,000, 400,000 years ago. And they become extinct around 30,000 years ago, generally in connection with that modern humans with skeletons very much like ours today appear on the scene. And after many, there was a big, big debate in paleontology since 30 years about what happened when modern humans came out and met these Neanderthals in Europe and other forms of extinct humans in Asia. So one side of this big debate claimed that it was total replacement, that these modern humans come out of Africa, meet Neanderthals and these other forms in Asia and replace them without any mixture whatsoever. Another idea was that modern humans come out of Africa, meet these forms, eventually replacement, but there is a contribution. They mix with each other. So there is a contribution from Neanderthals to Europeans today and from other forms in Asia to Asians today. So you can see this as a sliding scale, if you like, from 0% contribution from these forms, total replacement, to more and more contribution. And we got the first chance to test this back in 96 then, when we got samples not just from any Neanderthal, but from the Neanderthal, so to say, that was found in Neanderthal in 1856. And gave its name to these groups of organisms. And it was actually the first time one realized that there were other forms of humans that had been out there, that had existed before present-day humans. So with the technology of the time, we cumbersomely focused on a particularly variable part of this mitochondrial genome then that's particularly easy to retrieve and that we have from our mothers, doing many, many experiments, believing the things we could reproducibly find there. And we estimated such a tree then for the relationship of the mitochondrial genomes of present-day people, which all go back to common ancestor between 100,000 and 200,000 years ago, and the Neanderthal mitochondrial genome that went back much, much further to about 500,000 years ago or so. And since then, we and others have looked at other mitochondrial DNAs from other Neanderthals too, and they all fall outside the variation of present-day humans. So in this sort of sliding scale view of things, it's total replacement. There are no people today running around with Neanderthal mitochondrial genomes. They have all gone. So that was then the view about from the mitochondrial genome. And I think I'm on the published record 8 years ago or something like that of saying we will never see the nuclear genome of a Neanderthal. There's too little there of it. It's too degraded. It's too chemically modified. And you should, of course, never make negative statements like that because you're generally proven wrong. And what proves you wrong is generally technology. And in this case, it was high-throughput DNA sequencing that came around. The ability to sequence in these types of machines millions of DNA molecules very rapidly and inexpensively. So instead of cumbersomely trying to retrieve a particular piece of DNA you're interested in, you can simply extract all the DNA from such a fossil, sequence all the molecules in there, make your little database, and start comparing it to the human genome to see what might come from the Neanderthal. And this worked for the first time from a cave site in Croatia, Vindija Cave in southern Europe, from a bone that was 38,000 years old, a little fragment of this bone. And what we found was that the DNA was indeed very degraded to short pieces. So whereas from a blood sample of me, you will retrieve fragments that are 10, 20,000 base pairs long, here the average is 50, 60 or so, very short. And the vast majority of the DNA is indeed not from the Neanderthal, but from microorganisms that have lived in the bone when it was deposited in the cave. So So our best samples have something like 3-3.5% endogenous DNA. So we worked, we then started this project. We were very lucky to get funding to try to study the entire genome of a Neanderthal, and we worked over 4 years on improving the techniques so that we are now today in the order of 500-fold more efficient in how we extract DNA from old bones and manipulate them to form that we can feed into the sequencing machines. And of course, sequencing machines also over this time have become more efficient in how much they can sequence. We looked through many, many different sites and Neanderthal bones, but those with the most DNA in them, and put together a team of people with various competences and quirks that are partially in the book too, to sort of do this job, and identified 3 bones from this cave site in Croatia that we focused on, and sequenced a bit over 1 billion DNA fragments from these, the vast majority then from microorganisms. But we then matched those that we could match to the human genome with computer programs that we also developed specifically for this purpose. And in 2010, we then had a first overview where we had seen a little over half of the Neanderthal genome, so we could begin to ask questions. So many of those questions then involved population genetic questions. So we put together a team with several groups in the U.S. Particularly, I should mention Monte Slatkin and his group at UC Berkeley, and David Reich and Nick Patterson at the Broad Institute in Boston. And we then, one of the first questions we wanted to ask was this question: what happened when modern humans came out of Africa and met Neanderthals? Did one mix with each other or not? And we addressed that in very many different ways. But one way was then to say that if there had been mixing, we would expect Europeans today, of course, to share more genetic variants with Neanderthals than people in Africa, where there had never been Neanderthals, so we couldn't have contributed there. So to do this, then, we had our Neanderthal sequence, and we then worried a lot about errors in the present-day human genomes that other people had sequenced. So we went out and sequenced 5 present-day humans ourselves, not because we sequenced more accurately, but we would at least be sure that all 5 genomes had the same types of errors in equal frequencies. So we had one individual from Europe. For us, of course, the archetypical European is a French person, so we choose to sequence a French person. We had 2 African individuals, one person from China and one from Papua New Guinea. And then we did a very simple analysis. So taking 2 of the present-day humans, we just find all places where they differ from each other. And then we take the Neanderthal and say, how often does it match one person versus the other person today? And if we take the 2 Africans, since Neanderthals have never been in Africa, there's no reason that the Neanderthal should be closer to one African than the other African. And indeed, that is the case. The matching is sort of the same here, about 100,000 matches in each case. But if we took the European individual and an African individual, now we found significantly more matching to the European individual than the African individual. To my surprise, it seemed to have been a contribution here. Even more surprising was that when we took the Chinese individual and compared to the African individual, again we see more matching, although most people would say there had never been Neanderthals in China. And when we took the Papuan individual, we again see the same thing. And everyone would agree, I think even the paleontologist in the room, there had never been Neanderthals in Papua New Guinea. So this seemed puzzling. How could we find a Neanderthal contribution also in the parts of the world where Neanderthals had never been? So the model we came up with, which has since been borne out by other work, by both us and other groups, is to say that when modern humans came out of Africa, they presumably passed by the Middle East. And we know that there were Neanderthals in the Middle East. So if those humans, early modern humans, then mixed with Neanderthals in the Middle East, and then went on to become the ancestors of everybody outside Africa, they could sort of carry with them a Neanderthal contribution in their genome out to parts of the world where there had never been Neanderthals, such as China and Papua New Guinea. To the extent that if you analyze anybody whose ancestry is from outside Africa today, somewhere between 1 and 2% of their genomes come from Neanderthals. So there have been since been quite a lot of scientific follow-up work about this, which has been very satisfying. I can never stop myself from sort of mentioning that there's lots of public interest in this too. Lots of people write to us letters and emails and self-identify as Neanderthals and offer to give blood samples. And after a while looking at all these emails, I started noticing a pattern. And that was that it was mostly men who wrote and self-identified as Neanderthals, and very few women. So I sort of then presented this to my group, sort of my research. I also do something, I count emails. And they are, of course, very critical, particularly of everything I do. So they said, this is just ascertainment. This is just because men are more interested in molecular genetics. They will write to you. Women are not interested, so they will not write. But I went back to my mails and found that that is not true, because there are plenty of women who write to me and say they are married to Neanderthals, actually. Whereas so far there is not a single man who has claimed he is married to a Neanderthal woman. So as a geneticist, you of course then become very interested in how this goes on. But we do other things, of course, in counting emails too. One thing that we're interested in is other extinct forms of humans. There are of course many other forms of humans that we don't know how they are related to Neanderthals and present-day humans. And we're particularly lucky to work together with Professor Anatoly Derevyanko in Novosibirsk and his team, who excavated many different sites in Siberia, particularly then in a cave site called Denisova Cave in southern Siberia on the border to China, where Kazakhstan, Mongolia, and China sort of meet. And it's a very beautiful area, and in this cave site, they in 2008 found a tiny little bone that they were very skilled in realizing that it might actually be a hominid bone. It was a fragment of the last phalanx of a pinky, of a child. So we extracted DNA from this fragment, and to our surprise, this was quite well preserved. 70% of the DNA was actually of hominin origin in it. So it allowed us then to compare it to Neanderthals and present-day humans. And to our surprise, we found that it was neither a Neanderthal nor a modern human. It had a common origin with Neanderthals, but far back in time, over 200,000 years ago or so, and Neanderthals had a long independent history. So we named this sort of new group of extinct humans and Denisovans after the site, Denisova Cave, where they were first found, just as Neanderthals are named after Neander Valley, where they were first seen. And we've since gone on to develop even more efficient methods in retrieving tiny amounts of very degraded DNA. So we now have a very high quality genome of this little girl that it turns out to be, where we have sequenced every position in the genome many, many times over. So of the part of the genome where we can map these short fragments to, we actually have seen every position that there is, to a quality that's even higher than most genome sequences from present-day living people. So we can then begin to do some cool things. We can, for example, say that since this person died some tens of thousands of years ago, they, of course, have missing mutations, so to say, compared to present-day people, because they died some time back, so they have not accumulated as much mutations as people who live today. And indeed, compared back to the common ancestor with the chimp, there's around 1% of the mutations here that are missing. So if we assume that this common ancestor with the chimpanzee is 6.5 million years ago, we can actually date this bone to somewhere between 60 and 80,000 years ago. So this is fascinating to me, that this bone is so small that you cannot even do a carbon date from it. But when we can determine the genome, we can actually estimate its age from these missing mutations. There are sort of still caveats about this, particularly with regard to errors in the present-day human sequences here, but this is certainly an indication of what will become possible in the future, I think, when we are even more accurate with our DNA sequencing. We can ask for these people, the Denisovans, did they contribute to present-day humans? And yes, indeed, they did. And to our surprise, this has particularly happened out in the Pacific. So in Papua New Guinea, Aboriginal Australians, Fiji, and so on. So this suggests then that these Denisovans were presumably more widespread in the past, that modern humans that came to Southeast Asia met them and interbred with them. So this is sort of an indication, I think, about something that's both very stimulating and frustrating, that from a tiny little bone fragment, you can reconstruct a lot of the population history of a group. You can see how they contribute to present-day humans, even date them. But we have no idea how these individuals looked, what stone tools they made, or other things that you would normally know about old remains. But it's also something, I think, that will become more sort of common, this situation, in the future. So what we have also done very recently and published in January this year is to determine a good DNA sequence from a Neanderthal genome, also from a small bone from this Denisova cave, found deeper in a deeper layer, this time a toe bone. And we've sequenced this genome also to a quality higher than most genomes we have from present-day people. And one thing that then turned out surprising was that when we have such a high quality of a genome, we can, of course, distinguish a variance coming from the mother and the father of that individual. We can see the two variants of the genome that carries. And if we walk along a chromosome here, what we then found was that we found large, large areas, sometimes millions of base pairs, where the two genomes were identical and had no differences, something we don't see in the Denisova girl or in present-day humans. So this, of course, suggests that the parents of this individual were very closely related with each other. So from studying the genome, we can show that the parents must have been one of these four relationships that we see. So they could have been half-siblings, for example. They could have been a grandfather and a granddaughter. And there are some other things. Don't even ask me what a double first cousin is, because I can't describe it. But they were clearly closely related, and we see indications, too, that there were other closely related parents further back in the ancestry of this individual. So it will be very interesting to see in the future when we have other high-quality genomes from other Neanderthals if this was a common pattern in Neanderthals, or maybe something special going on in the eastern fringes in Siberia of their distribution. So we can now compare both this Denisova and the Neanderthals to each other, and we have then three Neanderthal genomes, the one from Croatia, one from the Caucasus, and this high-quality one from Siberia. And we can begin to see contributions also between, mixing between extinct groups of humans. So we see this contribution to present-day humans from Neanderthals and Denisovans. We see a small contribution from Denisovans also in mainland Asia, not only out in Oceania. But we do see also contribution from Neanderthals to Denisovans. And quite interesting, do we see a contribution from someone else into Denisovans, but not Neanderthals, something that diverged earlier on the human lineage, presumably Homo erectus or something like that, in Asia that mixed with them. So it's quite clear that mixing between groups have been rather common in the past. So if we would summarize here just our ideas about Neanderthal and Denisovan origins, they presumably have an origin in Africa 500,000 years ago or so. They come out of Africa and in Western Eurasia evolve into what we call Neanderthals. And in Eastern Eurasia to what we call Denisovans. There were clearly other forms of humans there too, not only Denisovans. We don't know where the sort of border between these groups were, but we know that at this site, Denisova site, in southern Siberia, at some time there were Neanderthals there, at some other time Denisovans there. Then modern humans evolve in Africa and spread to the Middle East and start spreading seriously around the world 50, 60,000 years ago. They mix with Neanderthals, presumably in the Middle East, continue out, and there is good new evidence from a group in Seattle that they mixed probably in Central Asia somewhere an additional time, because people in East Asia actually have slightly more Neanderthal ancestry than people in Europe. They mix with the Denisovans, modern humans, somewhere in Southeast Asia, and go out and colonize the Pacific. And these earlier archaic forms of humans then become extinct. But live on, if you like, a little bit in people today, in that, say, 1 or 2% of people in Eurasia have Neanderthal ancestry and an additional 5% of Denisovan ancestry in people in Polynesia then. Now, we've studied two archaic groups and we found two cases of admixture. I wouldn't be surprised if one finds other groups, say, in China in the future that have also contributed. And that in Africa, this may also have gone on, although it's harder to show because we have no old genomes from Africa, at least yet. But what has happened is that we've clearly disproven this total replacement idea. We have this contribution of a few percent from these earlier groups to present-day humans. But we shouldn't lose track of that the big picture is still one of replacement. It's still true that the vast majority, 90-95% of our genetic variation comes out of Africa. So just as a term for this, I like to suggest, say, leaky replacement or so. The big picture is replacement, and we have a little bit of a contribution. So just before ending, a few minutes then about another aspect of this work that we will, I think, will become very interesting in the next few years. And that is that when we now have these high-quality genomes from our closest extinct relatives, then we can start focusing on mutations that happen in modern humans since we separated from the Neanderthals and became fixed, became present in all present-day humans, no matter where we live on the planet. So things that happened and spread to all humans quite recently in our history, in the last 100, 200,000 years. And why would these changes be particularly interesting? Well, I do think they are interesting because humans, modern humans, are quite special among these other groups of humans. Neanderthals lived for 300, 400,000 years, and their technology did not change dramatically during that time. In the last, Neanderthals have some innovations that may have to do that they actually have met modern humans. But with modern humans, of course, within 100,000 years, technology changed dramatically. Our technology today is quite different from 100,000 years ago. Figurative art, cane paintings, figurines come only with modern humans. And modern humans are, of course, the first hominins that spread across open water. With just one exception, there is no evidence that these earlier forms ever spread across water where you don't see land on the other side. So sometimes I say they were not mad, but we are mad. Within 50,000 years, we spread not only to Australia and Americas, but to every little speck of land in the Pacific. And how many people must not just sail out on the Pacific and perish before you found Easter Island? And we will never stop. We go to the moon, we go to Mars. This, of course, had to do with technology, but also something perhaps in our attitude. So we hope that some of the biological background of this would be hidden in those genetic changes that are typical of modern humans. So if we now are very strict and say, what are the genetic changes that are present in, as far as we can tell, 100% of people today, no matter where we live on the planet, yet at those places in the genome, Neanderthals, Denisovans look like the apes, things that happened quite recent in human history, then that's not a very long list. It's a little over 30,000 changes in the genome. So whereas I, as an individual, differ from an individual Neanderthal at, say, 3 million or 3.5 million positions, if we take just those changes that we all have together and where we differ from Neanderthals, it's just 30,000 of them. So this is, if you like, a genetic recipe for being a fully modern human. So the hope is that among these changes we'll hide some that are important. And they are indeed not many. You can look through them in 2-3 hours in your computer, right? And among proteins, for example, the molecules that really make the job in our cells, there are 96 changes in 87 proteins. So these are these proteins. Of course, we have a bias to thinking that things in the brain might be particularly interesting. So there are, for example, an over representation among these 87 genes, among those expressed in the part of the brain during fetal development, the neuron where nerve cells are born, where stem cells divide and form neurons. among those proteins, just to give you a feeling for how you might speculate about what might be important, there are three proteins that are part of the machinery that pull the chromosomes apart when cells divide. And it's known that the cleavage plane and how the cell division takes place during nerve cell formation in the brain is very important for what types of neurons are born and how many of them are born. So among these 87 proteins, one might speculate that these three ones, for example, are particularly interesting to study. And many groups in the world, including ours, will, of course, hopefully study that now. So just before ending, one can say this raises an issue, of course. We want to study human-specific changes, and how do we really do that efficiently? We, per definition, have no really animal model we can study. So there are people such as your church, a professor at Harvard, who have suggested that what we should now do when we have these genomes is to go and clone Neanderthals, engineer these changes into human stem cells and generate individuals. And I think there are many, many reasons why that will not happen. There are, in fact, technical reasons, but there are even stronger ethical reasons, of course, why one would never, ever do this. But it's not just a sort of joking matter. The question is, how will we actually go on with this? And I think one thing that will happen is that one will be able to find back mutations in the human population. The human genome is just 3 billion bases, as we said. There are 7 billion humans on the planet. We said in the beginning that every new baby carries 100 or 200 new mutations. So that means that all mutations that are all compatible with human life exist out there in the population today as a natural experiment. But they are generally at very low frequency. So you will have to try to go and find them. But in a longer perspective, when all of us will have our genome sequenced, when we just walk into the doctor's office, I think it will be possible to go out and find mutations and study those individuals. It will be probably possible to overcome the sort of ethical issues with that. You can, of course, begin engineering these changes now in human stem cells and ape stem cells and differentiate them to cells, to say, liver cells and nerve cells in the tissue culture in the lab and study them, and that will happen. And something that will also happen and is beginning to happen is that you can put these changes or these human genes with various changes into mouse models and then study them in an organism with the limitations that has, but that is still a viable way forward that we will see, I think. So I hope I convinced you that if you're then interested in human evolution, recent human evolution, our recent past that set us on this very special trajectory that brought humans to living across the whole globe, being so numerous so that we actually influence large part of the biospheres today, it's very useful to have the genomes of our closest relatives to help us. But in the long run, to really understand what happened here, it will not be enough to just look at the genomes. We will have to do functional work. And one of the most viable ways is then actually to humanize mice, I think. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
Our thanks to Dr. Pavel for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Neanderthal Man in Search of Lost Genomes with Dr. Svante Pavel. Now we open the floor to a Q&A. Please keep your questions short and to the point, and also make sure your questions are, in fact, questions and not statements. And I'll be passing around the microphone, and make sure to speak into the microphone as we are recording.
Do you have any hidden Homo erectus bones?
No, I sometimes say we have sequenced a bit of Homo erectus in the Denisovan genome because there's a contribution there from something that might be Homo erectus. No, we don't, but I would hope perhaps in China that one will be able to find something. There are things in China that are rather recent that are called Homo erectus, at least, that would be very interesting. This Homo floresiensis would, of course, also be very interesting. I think preservation is very bad there, though. Like 6-7 years ago, we tried a little bit from tooth root of the teeth and could not get anything. And so I fear that will be impossible.
Do you have DNA from Flores man?
Yes, so the question is Homo floresiensis. And unfortunately, we tried 6-7 years ago and couldn't retrieve anything. Now, we have gotten better since that time, but it's also true that preservation is very bad. There is humid and warm, and I fear it's not possible.
Neanderthals supposedly had larger brains than modern humans. Why didn't they evolve? Why did they just stay stuck in their evolutionary?
Yes, I don't know if they were really stuck. I guess it's modern humans that came around and was very bad for their health, probably. Of course, we would probably, maybe if we one day understand what makes modern humans special, we may be able to speculate more fruitfully about what happened. Of course, just brain size is not really either what matters. They had size, relative to their body size, they were just slightly bigger brains, as I understand it. Also had slightly bigger bodies than humans at the time. But yes, I think it's something special with modern humans simply. It's not just Neanderthals. All these other forms of humans have also disappeared. The last 30,000 years of our history is indeed unique in that we are alone. And all these other forms, there was a much greater diversity of humans before that.
When studying variation, is there a risk for a bottleneck effect for the genomes for the samples you have?
So for the Neanderthals, you mean, yes. So we actually see that Neanderthals have even less variation than present-day humans. They have certainly a very small size, and that's true for the Denisovans too. We're, of course, trying to be careful to not draw conclusions that would be affected by that. So, for example, finding this list of things that are unique to modern humans, as long as something is ancestral, the ape-like state in even a single Neanderthal, we know that that ape-like state was present in the common ancestor. Even if other Neanderthals would turn to have the human-like state, it was at least variable then. So, for example, so we try to sort of avoid things that would be influenced by that, yes.
Do you think that the population that became the Neanderthals diverged from the native population of Africa before they left, or did they become something different after they left?
Well, morphologically, I think my understanding is that the Neanderthal morphologies only seen in Eurasia and evolves there and even becomes more extreme as time goes on. And then we have these Denisovan relatives of them, right? I would think that the common ancestor of Denisovans and Neanderthals come out of Africa and sort of diverge in Eurasia. We have recently been able to retrieve DNA from something that's 400,000 years old in Spain, something most people would call Homo floresiensis or so, and study just the mitochondrial DNA so far. That turns out to be an early branch of actually the Denisovan mitochondrial DNA. So it at least shows that, say, 400,000 years ago, something somehow related to the Denisovans, but perhaps also, probably also Neanderthals, was there in Europe. But we would really have to look in the nuclear genome to understand the full picture.
In view of the contamination problem, how credible are the DNA analyses by forensic groups, police, and others?
Oh, that's sensitive to ask, particularly if it's going to be on radio. I think I'm not in a position to make any general statements about that, right? But we really have to look in the specific cases, too.
This is curiosity on my part, but have you sequenced your own genome? And if so, what is the percentage of Neanderthal and Denisovan?
So I have actually not sequenced my own genome, yet at least. It's becoming easier and easier. We might sequence several people in our lab, perhaps then including me in the future. But the percentage of Neanderthal contribution is rather similar across people. It's 1%, 1.2%. But we all carry, or many of us carry, different pieces. So there were two recent papers that came out in January, one from Josh Aikis' group in Seattle and one from David Rice's group in Boston that we were involved in the study. So one can sort of puzzle together much of the Neanderthal genome now just from people in this room, say, or from present-day people. And you can come to something like 35% of the genome from looking in present-day people. And then, interestingly, there are other parts you do not get. There seems to be resistant to Neanderthal contribution. So although you would expect to see parts there too, you don't. And if you look in those parts of the genome, there's one group of genes that are overrepresented statistically, and that's genes expressed in the male germlines in testicles. So that sort of suggests, one reasonable suggestion by that is that the hybrids had problems with male fertility, which is rather typical of closely related groups that come together, say horses and donkeys or so. The male's offspring is infertile and the females are fertile. So there may actually even have been a partial biological barrier actually to mixing.
Will you be doing any work on the cave in Denisova, the five skulls? Are you going to be doing any of that genomic study?
The
cave in southern Siberia, and excuse me, in Denisova.
The Manisi,
with the five skulls.
In the Caucasus. It is too old, I think. That is sort of approaching 2 million years, I think. We are trying some older sites now. We would try animal bones then, of course, to see if it works technically. But 2 million years we haven't even gone to yet, thankfully. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen some reports recently that there's been some traces of genetic contribution from Europe back into Africa. Does that muddy your story in any way?
Yes, there's certainly evidence for gene flow back into Africa, so that you can see that sort of there is a partial European contribution. And there is even a paper where another group have shown that what little Neanderthal contribution you detect in Africa sort of correlates with that European contribution. So the only way you have Neanderthal contribution in Africa is actually via Europe, so to say.
Is there anything that we're missing by having to study the mitochondrial DNA rather than like nuclear DNA? That's one question. The second question is, are we optimistic that with the melting back of the glaciers, we might find some really well-preserved specimens, just as we found the Iceman in the Alps?
Yes. So of course, if you just study the mitochondrial genome, you're very limited. Right? You're just studying one piece of DNA that's inherited as a unit. So you either have it or not have it, so to say. And there's a big chance that a certain mitochondrial variant is lost. If a woman has no female offspring, it will not be passed on, right? So you study all the female side of history and only one instantiation of it, so to say. Whereas when we can now study the nuclear genome, you sort of have thousands and thousands of variable parts that you can trace back, and both from the male and female side. So.
Can you say something about the skeletons that were found in the school caves in the Middle East years ago, before all this DNA stuff came out? I remember one of my professors was talking about how they seemed to be specimens showing that there was, morphologically, some kind of interbreeding and that they were, related.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so these sites are then quite early and are most sort of really modern humans that are very, very early, before 100,000 years ago. So that is, of course, very interesting that there were modern humans in the Middle East that early. They had, as I understand it, a sort of technology that was then indistinguishable, really, from Neanderthals. They are probably not the direct ancestors of present-day people, or at least when we date the Neanderthal contribution, I should say, that is more recent than that. So the best estimate is between 40 and 90,000 years ago, where you can look from the size of the Neanderthal chunks we see, you can estimate how long ago they came into the modern human population. Because the first hybrids, of course, had one chromosome Neanderthal, one whole chromosome modern human. And then in each generation, these chromosomes recombine with each other and exchange pieces, so the chunks become smaller and smaller and smaller over time. So given the genetic recombination rate, you can estimate how long ago these fragments came in. And it's between 40 and 90,000 years. So maybe more, sort of a point estimate would be somewhere 50,000 years ago or so. So it's for sure the interbreeding we see the evidence of today was after the school and Cuffs individuals.
Can you comment on contributions the Neanderthal made to modern humans, perhaps in immunity gene?
In
a gene for immunity?
Ah, yes. So Peter Parham's group at Stanford have shown that one group of genes that have come from Neanderthals and also from Denisovans in other cases and have risen to high frequency in present-day humans, so have presumably had some positive influence in modern humans, so have really spread, are immune genes that regulate the immune system, so transplantation antigen genes. So that's quite interesting that some things that have come over from them have actually been positive from modern humans. And you can, of course, easily speculate that Neanderthals had lived for, say, 300,000 years in Central Asia and had adapted to pathogens around there, and then comes these Africans and mix with them that are not adapted to those pathogens. And, of course, immune response genes that are good to fight infections there will be advantageous. There was also a recent paper coordinated by a group in Boston on a risk gene, a variant of a gene that confers risk for type 2 diabetes in Native Americans. That risk variant turns out to come from Neanderthals, presumably into ancestors of Native Americans in Asia, and have risen to high frequency in Native Americans. And that's a good illustration, too, I think, about how we think about disease and that it's, of course, negative to get type 2 diabetes today. But those variants most likely give you an advantage in a situation of starvation. So presumably they came over and gave you an advantage in a time where you had periodic starvation. And today, when we have ample nutrition, we get type 2 diabetes if we carry those variants.
For those of us who are 1 to 2% Neanderthal, in addition to the last question, are there any other characteristics that might have come through?
Not that we know of. And we all, of course, carry different Neanderthal pieces, right? So there will be work, there are work going on, but there's nothing really come out of it yet where people try to associate Neanderthal variants with clinical features, say, or where one could imagine that, say, if you study MRIs of the heads where you see cranial morphology, some people, of course, carry some features that are sort of Neanderthal-like, and if one could associate that with a contribution from Neanderthals, it's possible that something like that would emerge in the future, but it's nothing known, I think.
Thank you so much. Our thanks to Dr. Svante Paabo for his comments here today. We also thank the audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Wow. Yeah. Thank you so much. Copies of the book, Neanderthal man in search of lost genomes available for purchase. And Svante is graciously staying around to field any additional questions you may have and sign your copy of the book. And also, I'd like to thank fellow club members who kindly volunteered for this program. They are Ron Proctor, Stuart Barkowitz, and Tom Devine. Thank you.